Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org. This is Capri Cafaro, host of Eat Your Heartland Out. And this week, we will introduce you to two people who are innovating how consumers access fresh food. Market Wagon co-founder Nick Carter joins the program to discuss how this virtual farmers market helps strengthen agriculture and small business while providing fresh, quality food to its consumers. And Emily Stucker tells us how her menu team at Farmer's Fridge helps make eating well easy, even when you're on the go. Emily, thanks so much for joining the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I have been really excited to talk to you for a long time because I am totally fascinated and frankly inspired by Farmer's Fridge and what y'all do. But for folks that maybe are not a Farmer's Fridge enthusiast or don't know what Farmer's Fridge is all about, tell us a little bit about what you do and how Farmer's Fridge got started.
Yeah. So, and I'm so glad to hear that you're such a fan. That's awesome. As we've grown over the last 10 years, it's been really incredible to just connect with everyone that has come across one. And it's becoming more and more common for someone to be like, oh, Farmer's Fridge, I walked by that in the airport. I love you guys. So that's so awesome. So Farmer's Fridge, we were founded about 10 years ago. And our mission is to make fresh, healthy food as accessible as a candy bar. And I really love that kind of visual that that gives you because that's what we are. We are a company of refrigerated vending machines across the country that instead of stocked with your typical Snickers and chips and things like that, you can find salads, grain bowls, wraps, sandwiches, healthy snacks, and things that are good for you in place of the stuff that typically isn't in vending machines across the country. And our founder, Luke, started the company about 10 years ago when he was traveling around the Midwest specifically. He was driving around. He was a traveling salesman and was having a really hard time finding healthy food on the go. And he found himself eating a lot from vending machines at either production facilities he was visiting or, rest stops on the highway, 7-Elevens, that kind of thing. And kind of noticed this huge gap in our food system of fresh, healthy food being accessible, both at a price point that's affordable for the majority of consumers, but then also location-wise, you kind of have these big consolidated pockets of restaurants and, QSR, quick service restaurants, that kind of thing. But there's sort of this huge gap in the middle where it's really hard to find produce and fresh, healthy food on the go.
Yeah, no question about it. And, the airport just seems like the most perfect place for it too, because particularly now, since it's so hard, to get a meal on board an airline anymore, no matter what class of service that you're flying, it's so tough to be able to eat healthy when you're on the road. And I know this because I'm always on the road, which is, again, why I'm excited about Farmer's Fridge. So such a good idea. What does your footprint look like now?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's changed a lot over the last 10 years. So when Luke, our founder, started it, it was one vending machine in a food court. I don't even think that food court exists anymore in downtown Chicago. And then say COVID changed a lot of things, I'm sure, with yep. that kind of space. But we now have over 1,000 Farmer's Fridges across the country. We have expanded outside of just the Midwest. So we are in Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Ohio. We're in the Northeast market, New Jersey, New York, Boston, DC, Philly, kind of all the major markets you would expect. We've expanded to Texas. We're in Austin, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio. And then we've also hit the West Coast in LA and San Diego. And we're continuing to expand. You can typically find farmers' fridges in, I think you mentioned airports. That's kind of where, you know, most people recognize us of just, there's that big billboard, you're in a rush, everything's closed, everything's like $15 and or more, and there's a giant line. And so Farmer's Fridge is a really awesome offering in airports that, you know, consumers find very, very valuable. We're also in other verticals, we call them, but college campuses, hospitals, and office buildings are kind of our main ones for fridge placements. And then we've recently expanded into retail as well.
I've noticed that.
Yeah. So it's been definitely an adventure over the last year. It's a very different business and channel than our fridge network, where we kind of own everything end to end. But we are currently in Midwest, Costco's, and Target's. And then we're working on sort of other expansion with other retailers and then other markets as we're expanding that channel as well.
That's really unbelievable. Now, has that changed kind of your offerings? Usually in the vending machines, you see, you know, salads and, you know, they come in these really, you know, cool little jars. How has, or if it has changed at all, how has it changed your menu offerings going into retail?
Yeah, that's a great question. It honestly has not changed it much yet. That's part of kind of the offering is, you know, we have these kind of single serve, they're recyclable jars and they're salads, bowls, as I mentioned. We're leveraging that in the retail environment. So in the same way that you might purchase a bunch of items from a fridge, you can buy the same things at Costco and Target. We found that to work really well for us. I think, you know, as we think about expanding and kind of solidifying that channel, it is a different purchase occasion, right? You're potentially stocking up for the week. It might not be immediate consumption, although I do think there are a lot of people that, you know, buy it and then go home right away, or they eat it for lunch as they're kind of doing their errands out of the house. But I could definitely see other innovation platforms happening in the near future to support retail. But right now, you know, the fridges are our core business. We want them to continue to be our core business. And I'll talk a little bit about this of why that's necessary, just in terms of the network and the systems we've built on our fridges that retail kind of rides on top of, but could never exist on its own. Right. And so we're continuing to prioritize fridges, and then to whatever extent we can add on retail and continue to innovate other options for consumers under the Farmer's Fridge brand, we'll definitely continue to do that as we scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stick on the fridges then. I mean, you said you would talk a little bit about that model and why it's, you know, still remaining the core of the business. Tell us why.
Yeah. So everyone always asks, you know, how did you think of this? Like, why salad in a vending machine? It kind of feels like an oxymoron. You know, you're used to vending machines being A, not refrigerated, and then also carrying, you know, items that have probably been in there for months, maybe years. And so we do definitely run into this stigma of like, how do I know it's fresh? Is it going to taste good? And so that's really what we've been working on over the last 10 years, is kind of breaking down that stigma and really building that trust for our brand of the freshness and the quality. And we've come a long way, and people are, you know, more comfortable with it now. If you think about it, the reason restaurants can't go into a lot of the locations where our fridges are is because the unit economics would never work. Mm-hmm. If you think about the overhead for a restaurant, you need, you know, a lot of space. You know, our fridge is a couple feet by a couple feet. You just need a, you know, GCFI plug-in outlet and you're good to go. You would need labor, you would need rent, and the traffic for that would be needed to make those economics work would never be enough in the office building. And they would never be enough in, you know, the healthcare lobby outside of the cafeteria, that kind of thing. And so that's really where the vending machine comes in, where all of a sudden now, like, we have consolidated the labor and the rent and all of those things in the food production. Mm-hmm. And we just need to distribute to that vending machine. And all of a sudden, the traffic that's necessary makes that those unit economics work in a way that we can place fridges where most restaurants that serve fresh food can't go.
That makes total sense. And I mean, you're really serving a need, you know, as you said, I mean, because that is really not, you're serving niches where other providers are not necessarily going to go because it doesn't make dollars and cents. And you've managed to scale it in a way, and you're bringing a quality product to those folks that are, you know, accessing it through whether it is, you know, particularly the vending machines. But then, of course, as you've also expanded into retail, you know, it seems to me you're probably helping a lot of people with their weekly meal prep, right?
For sure. Yeah, we hope so. We hope so. Yeah. And the size of the prize for, you know, vending machine placement is enormous. I think that's the other thing. If you think about, there are over 7 million vending machines in the United States, which is kind of crazy to think about how many people eat out of a vending machine every day.
That's a good point.
And the closest, I think the kind of QSR restaurant that has the most locations in the U.S. is Subway. And that's 20,000. So if you think about that gap between the, you know, largest location unit that's serving fresh food and a vending machine, that gap between 20,000 and 7 million is enormous. And that's really the sweet spot of where Farmer's Fridge is serving and where we will continue to expand to serve that need over the coming years.
Yeah. So, I mean, I am, again, continuously impressed by what you all are doing. And I want to kind of switch gears on our conversation about the actual product, right? We've talked a little bit about the business model and how, you know, how you get this product out into people's hands, into their mouths, right? But you are the VP for menu. And so we have to pick your brain about how you develop the products that you sell and how you source those products to make sure that they, you know, come in fresh and stay fresh.
Yeah, yeah. So I could definitely talk about this for a while if you get me started. So I lead the menu team here at Farmer's Fridge kind of from the initial ideation and recipe development all the way through commercialization. And that's been really an intentional choice we've made to keep those functions integrated in the way that we're organized because we need to move so quickly and so much of the product tasting good when it gets to a fridge is operational given the number of constraints we're working in. So we're really intentional about the recipes we create. Our overall goal is to make fruits and vegetables more accessible to more people. So we want to reduce the bad stuff. We want to increase the good stuff. And this requires working within those tight set of constraints to make that possible. And I can talk a little bit about those. The first one is, you know, the food has to taste good. It sounds obviously very, you know, obvious, I guess, but we can't just steam broccoli and put it in a jar, right? Nobody would crave that. Nobody would want to eat it. And so as we're thinking about nutrition guardrails, that's really our number one priority. All of our salads have at least two servings of fruits and vegetables. Our bowls have at least the other items and kind of meals have at least one. And so that's really what we're prioritizing. While at the same time, we don't use any weird stuff. So we're not using artificial preservatives or flavors. Mm-hmm. The way that we're kind of getting the longer shelf life out of our items is a lot of testing. We're testing different cuts. There's certain ingredients that we don't use anymore because we know that they would never make it more than 2 days before they're just not good anymore. We're testing different layering. So you'll see our salads, you know, there's a lot of them have sort of a grain base on the bottom that's really helpful in kind of absorbing any moisture that might come out of the vegetables on top of it. And we're creating a moisture barrier, we kind of call it, with the shredded cheese that sits between the vegetables and the lettuce. So we're really thoughtful of how we're not only choosing the ingredients and building the recipes, but also just the structure of the ingredients as they go into the jar is really important in creating food that tastes good, but then also lasts the amount of time it needs to make it to the end consumer and still taste fresh and delicious.
How do you figure that out? I mean, how much testing, and what does that testing look like? Like, I'm just kind of fascinated. I mean, you know, get something out of a vending machine, or you pick it up at a store, and you kind of take for granted, like, here it is. You just kind of maybe assuming, okay, this is, it looks nice from the outside, and it packs everything into this jar, but it sounds like there's a lot more thought that goes into it than that.
Yes, yeah, for sure. So we eat a lot. we do a lot of recipe development. We're constantly, you know, playing around with different stuff. We've built a pretty turnkey kind of internal testing process that we use. So we have built our own sort of set of methodology and test criteria that we focus on. So we do a lot of internal tasting panels. We'll have, you know, people in the office come. We need a certain number of data points, but then we know what questions to ask. They're rating these things on a scale of 1 to 5 over the course of a couple of days. And we now have built up a pretty substantial data system with some benchmarks. So we tend to know and kind of be able to predict now whether something is going to work at scale. And we'll test that throughout the life of the kind of innovation process. So the first part is a lot of just testing in the recipe development kitchen, right? So does this have legs? Is this something that people are interested in? We might send out sort of an email or a poll to our customers and do a concept test to confirm that, yep, people want this flavor. Or if we're deciding between two different flavors, we'll kind of get some input there. And then we'll kind of move it through, you know, most companies that work in product development have some type of stage gate process, which is basically just, you know, the stages that a item or project moves through as it kind of checks off boxes. So, okay, yep, this is a concept and a flavor people want. Great, let's move it to the next round of testing. Now we're going to actually build recipes and get people to give feedback on the recipe. Is it delivering on what the concept is? Okay, check. Then we'll move it to, okay, can we make this in our production facility in a way that matches what we made just in our, you know, test kitchen here. And so we'll kind of like go through rounds and rounds of iteration. We're typically working on a 20-week development cycle from, you know, kind of initial recipe development to product in fridge. And then because we own everything and we're not, you know, contracting with another manufacturer or anything like that, we're pretty easily able to iterate if we see customer feedback come in, or once it's in production, we have some checkpoints after it launches for our team to just continue to taste it, keep our eye on it. Is this meeting what we had initially intended it to originally in the development process? And we kind of take all of that data and continue to tweak until we're happy with it. And we get that feedback from consumers, both in terms of the qualitative feedback that they send us directly, but then also obviously sales,
you know,
and
selling
of that,
yeah,
item. Exactly. And you learn that pretty quickly now.
Sure. Is there anything that has been in the fridges for the last 10 years that has been a constant?
Oh, wow. There are some. So our berries and granola Greek yogurt, that one has been on the menu for 10 years. It's gone through a couple iterations and it seems so simple, but it's just really good quality yogurt that we mix honey and some Madagascar vanilla into. And then there's fresh cut apples, blueberries, and a house-made granola.
Very nice.
I'm trying to think what else. There's a couple things that have been on, but we do a lot of rotation too. So we'll pull something off, put it back on just to, you know, keep it fresh and make sure we only have a certain number of slots in the fridges. And so for our customers that are coming back, you know, every week, they want some variety too. And so we're kind of constantly taking a look at that, making sure that our assortment is fresh and supplemented with some, you know, LTOs and seasonal items that highlight seasonal ingredients and flavors and that kind of thing.
I'm glad you brought up the seasonal ingredients, because that was going to be what I was going to ask you next, since you were talking about, you know, that regular rotation, which makes sense, obviously, for, you know, for the end user, the consumer who does want variety, particularly if you're, for example, in an office building as opposed to, you know, an airport, maybe you're only going through every so often as opposed to, you know, that's where you are 5 days a week. But, yeah. you know, I'm curious about the seasonality of the ingredients you choose and how you decide to, you know, incorporate, you know, produce that happens to be in season.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's changed and gotten both easier in some ways and challenging in others as we've scaled, because the volumes we're talking about now are helpful in some ways, you know, in terms of buying power and contracting full truckloads eventually and things like that. But it's also tricky because if you run out or something comes in, and, you know, the wildfires in California last year was really challenging, sure, across the entire produce supply chain. But, you know, if all of a sudden the green leaf comes in and all the tips are burnt, it's safe, but it's not, you know, not the best foot forward in terms of quality, but that's the whole market. And so what do you do when you need 10,000 pounds of green leaf? You know, like there isn't, you can't just run to Whole Foods anymore and kind of buy up what they have on the shelf. So the biggest thing, you know, is making sure that our produce and incoming product, seasonal or not, they tend to go kind of hand in hand in terms of quality though, is that it's high quality and safe. So we have a very rigorous food safety and supplier approval process that starts actually way before the ingredients even get to our facility. We're obviously washing the produce ourselves. We're putting all of those, you know, we're cooking things and roasting them and we're chopping them. And we're kind of doing all of that in-house to make sure that, A, it's safe and the quality's good, but also from a shelf life perspective, that's that if we sourced lettuce pre-cut, that's already lost a couple days of shelf life by the time it gets to us. And so that time from the time that we wash it, chop it, and get it into a jar, and then ship it out that night to fridges needs to be as short as possible. And that's sort of key in the freshness and keeping the items fresh in the fridge. In terms of the ingredients, a lot of them are evergreen, right? So we've been really good about, in order for them to be high quality and safe, but also reliable, we can't, it's really hard to turn things on and off really quickly at our volumes now. And so we've built this sort of standard pantry of ingredients that are kind of evergreen. So we know that generally it might switch between green Arcadian and green leaf, or maybe we'll supplement with some spinach or some cabbage during the transition months. For those that don't know, there's two main growing seasons, and they kind of alternate between Salinas, California and Yuma, Arizona. And during that transition time is when you typically see a good amount of kind of quality issues as the whole region is transferring over to the other region. And so we try to build in some flexibility to supplement to make sure that that quality continues to be good. And then we're focusing on seasonal flavors. So we have an apple pecan salad right now that's using, you know, Honeycrisp apples and Fuji apples, because those are in season and really high quality. So we kind of supplement both seasonally, but the biggest thing is making sure that we have a reliable and safe ingredient supply that we, that our R&D team can kind of pull from.
Sounds like you all thought of absolutely everything. and it's no wonder, obviously, why you have such a strong quality product. You take a lot of time and a lot of care, which is just absolutely fantastic. What's on the horizon now for Farmer's Fridge? I mean, we've talked about retail, we've talked about other things, but, you know, I know that, you know, part of the objective is to make sure, as we started this conversation, that healthy food is as accessible as, you know, a Snickers bar or candy bar or whatever. And then, you know, you mentioned the fact that the jars are also recyclable. You know, how much is sustainability important for the future of Farmer's Fridge?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. Sustainability is so important to us. It's tricky, right? Because there are trade-offs in every kind of conversation that you talk about for sustainability. And we spend a lot of time and energy and care and thinking about those things. The packaging is one that we get. Obviously, there it's plastic, right? It's recyclable plastic. We know that plastic isn't ideal. We've looked at a bunch of different options, and we have a team that's kind of continuing to scope other options. But at the end of the day, our mission is, again, to make fruits and vegetables more accessible to more people. And so part of that is, one, doing it in a way that is cost effective so that most people can, you know, it's an approachable price point. It's about half the cost of your kind of average item at Sweetgreen, if you do a comparison. And that's really important. The second piece is the shelf life. So making sure that items can hold up for as long as they need to get to a machine in these areas that typically there isn't access to fresh, healthy food. And so that is part of our challenge, is balancing those sustainability goals and initiatives in a way that does not detract from that overall mission. Mm-hmm. One kind of anecdotal piece on packaging that I like to use as an example just to kind of make it tangible is we, in the past, I think it was a couple of years ago, we actually changed, we had a wrap, you know, we have a Baja chicken wrap, we've had a couple different flavors of wraps over time. We actually changed that package to be made of compostable cardboard in a way to try to reduce, we kind of overall want to reduce our virgin plastic usage, and that was one way to do so. But one of the unintended side effects was it was less airtight, right? Because compostable material is a little bit more porous. And so the shelf life was cut in half. And so we actually ended up with more food waste as a result, which is obviously the last thing we want, right? And so on the surface, it's like, oh, that's more sustainable because it's compostable versus a plastic jar. But at the end of the day, we made that product less accessible and we created more food waste. So we need to look at the whole system, and that's something that we're constantly doing. We've recently moved all of our plastic jars to incorporate post-consumer recycled plastic, right, to reduce virgin plastic output, create more demand downstream. We're partnering with a packaging supplier in Wisconsin who's been an incredible partner that actually collects plastic back and has their own wash system that then can create 100% recycled plastic. And that's what we're using for our sandwiches today in a way that doesn't degrade shelf life. So these things take a while, but it's easy on the surface to point to things and say, oh, that's bad, that's bad. But at the end of the day, we need to achieve our overall mission and make sure that we're not making sort of a knee-jerk decision that seems right from a sustainability perspective, but on the whole is actually worse off in general. So we're kind of constantly balancing all these things.
Sure. No, that, I mean, again, I am consistently impressed by how much thought goes into and care goes into the creation of the product, the sourcing of everything that goes into what you provide to the consumer, and ultimately sticking with that core mission. One final question that I was just thinking of as we've been talking about the fact that, you know, particularly the fridges are in places where maybe fresh food in particular is not readily accessible. Has there ever been any discussions about integrating Farmer's Fridge in a way that might help serve food deserts in, you know, whether it's inner city communities or even rural communities that may grow our food, but people have to drive, you know, maybe the only access to food they have is, you know, a gas station, with some limited grocery items.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely been an ongoing discussion. We've done initiatives on and off over the years to address this. It's definitely something that we would love to get more into on the horizon. I think, you know, one of the challenges, it would require a good amount of kind of community embedment and partnership. And so we've talked to, you know, like we've had prior conversations with health insurance companies and community centers and things like that, because it would just, you know, plopping a fridge down and saying, here you go,
That's not going to necessarily make it any more accessible than anything else just is there.
Right, exactly. And so you kind of have to start at the community level. And so that is something that is certainly on the horizon. We needed to build the network first. And so last year we launched, I think, 12 out of our 22 markets were just launched last year. And so that's what the last couple of years have truly been about, is just gain the expansion of our network that we can now start to layer all these things on, because there's already a Farmer's Fridge van driving past that location that you're talking about. And so all of a sudden now the density that we can build on the routes and the markets we're in, that's where you start to layer on those types of initiatives. And the opportunity for that is huge as we continue to expand. So it's definitely something that I hope that we can get into sooner rather than later.
I figured it would probably be at least in the mix, given the mission and vision that that Farmers Fridge has for, you know, its communities and the communities that it serves. This has been such a blast, Emily. I really enjoyed this conversation. I know our listeners will as well. If they want to learn more about Farmers Fridge and maybe where one might be in their community, how can they learn more?
Yes. Yeah. So you can visit us at farmersfridge.com. We also have an app that will, you can type in your location. It'll show you your nearest fridge. Definitely look out for us in any airport that you're in. We're typically in them. We're in a lot of them now. You can, we also have all of our social channels as well that you can obviously look us up on, but the app is probably the best place to go and the easiest way. You can order directly from that and find the nearest fridge near you.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Emily. Thanks for sharing Farmer Fridge's story and for, I think, making us all a little bit more hungry and willing to grab for a salad as opposed to a candy bar.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really had fun today.
This is Eat Your Heartland Out with me, Capri Cafaro. After the break, I'll welcome my next guest, Nick Carter, co-founder of Market Wagon.
Nick, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I have known about Market Wagon for a little while, and it is really an intriguing idea. What was the spark for Market Wagon?
It was pretty simple. I'm a farmer myself. I'm a fourth generation Indiana farmer, grew up on a farm, left when I was 18, kind of as a statistic. You know, most of the people in my generation aren't staying in agriculture. It's been a well-known issue for U.S. farmers for a long time. And I saw an opportunity to kind of, I know it sounds trite, but save the family farm by going direct to consumer. And what we needed was the ability to have a marketplace to find the consumers and then get the product to them. And today, over 1,500 other farmers and food artisans are using the same.
So how does this work for a consumer? You know, you go online, you find, you know, Market Wagon, then what happens?
So it's a marketplace where you can, first thing is you put in your zip code or select a delivery area that you know you're within so that all the food you're shopping is from local farms that are right near you. And then you're shopping from all the different local farmers that are in your area. You can create a basket with products from all the different vendors. You can get bread from one place and ground beef or meats from one farm that you like their growing practices and eggs from a different and some produce from a different farmer. One single checkout, and then our system kind of aggregates all of those products and brings it to you in one delivery.
That seems almost too good to be true, right? the fact that you can really have that one-stop shop and you're able to do that with individual vendors, producers, farmers is really very, very unique. How many markets do you actually serve through Market Wagon?
Right now, we're in 19 states with just 22 fulfillment centers or markets, if you will. So throughout the Midwest, that includes, you know, Indianapolis, Fort Wayne, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Columbus. And in every one of those, it's somewhat of a, you know, rough math, an hour radius around those city centers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the real key is the technology that makes it possible.
And not to give away any state secrets, but, you know, how does this work on the back end? I mean, you know, how do you get all these different products to one place and keep them fresh?
Yeah, well, I mentioned that I left the farm when I was 18. And the kind of interlude in that story is that I became a tech entrepreneur and was a software engineer, had my own software startups, exited successfully. But in that process, you know, gained the experience of how to kind of create very powerful software that allows us to do just what we're talking about. So it's really, the efficiencies are driven by the technology. There's 7 years in the making and we still haven't perfected it. I mean, there's a lot of iterations that continue to take place, but the long and short of it is, you know, it's a matter of moving data, making sure that we know exactly what's available from the producers. You know, you don't want to buy lettuce from a farmer if they don't have enough to supply all the orders. And so there's the supply and inventory, if you will, what's available to be ordered. and then conveying those orders out on a timely basis. And the big thing that we use is batching. So orders could be delivered either once or twice a week. So it's not like next day delivery where we're bringing it to you the day that you order it. There's a little bit of planning involved. And that allows us to batch all of the orders together from different consumers going to different farms and then bring them to one centralized location where they can all be kind of remixed together into the different orders.
Mm-hmm. How do you identify the producers that you work with?
Every time we go to a market, it's pretty convenient. The kinds of producers that we want to work with, they all congregate every Saturday morning in a few random church parking lots around the city. We start with the farmers markets. And, what we've discovered is that the online farmers market, Market Wagon, is not competitive to farmers markets. The kinds of consumers who shop at physical farmers markets are there for the experience. They like shopping in that way. But that there are a lot of other consumers who want to buy this type of food raised this way, but the farmer's market itself doesn't fit their lifestyle for one reason or another. And so e-commerce is a new frontier. It's a new channel for these producers. And so we can bring them more customers, expand their opportunity to grow and sell what they grow on their farm. And that's how we go.
Do you find that that's an easy sell for farmers and producers, or do you find that it's met with hesitation because maybe they're not used to selling, in an e-commerce way, so it's unfamiliar and they don't really know what to expect?
Yeah, there's always a lot of questions with something new, and e-commerce is definitely, not first nature to a lot of farmers. The only reason why somebody would not be a Market Wagon is because they don't have what we call marginal supply, which means they're selling out of everything at the farmer's market anyways. And there's a lot of farmers that do that. They pack up and they go to the farmer's market on Saturday and they sell everything they could possibly grow. That's not going to be a good vendor on Market Wagon unless they have more land. They're just not planting yet because they need more demand, right? And they need more places to sell it. But the kinds of farms that are trying to find more and more sales, this is an easy opportunity for them.
What about the markets that you actually serve? I mean, how do you identify those centralized hubs, the Indianapolis's, the Cincinnati's, the Cleveland's, whatever? What process do you use to say, well, this is a viable market for us to deliver in?
Yeah. Well, it's not as sophisticated as it might sound like it should be. We're a Midwest company, first of all. So we've just kind of spread emanating out from Indianapolis like ripples on a pond. And if you look at the area that we serve today, you can just easily see how we've just spread across the Midwest terrain. And as far as where we can put one, we've kind of figured out mostly just through trial and error that we need roughly 1 million people within an hour's drive radius. Other than anything lower than that, and we'd love to be able to serve, but the reality is there's just not enough demand concentration to make the logistics work.
Sure.
So we have had to close a couple of hubs in some smaller areas. We used to operate in Evansville, Indiana. It's about 600,000 people. It's a decent-sized middle city, but it just wasn't enough critical mass to get it going.
That's surprising. It's a college town, right?
It's a small Evansville University's down there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You would think that might be something that would create demand. But you, as you said, it's going to be some trial and error through that process. You kind of touched upon this earlier because you had said that Market Wagon isn't necessarily a competitor to the traditional farmers market. Do you find that it is complementary to the traditional farmers market?
Yeah, very much so. The traditional farmers market is one day a week. And what we've seen with vendors who are good at tracking their data, right, and have paid close attention, they're reporting to us that the same customer who may buy from them at a farmers market once every 2 or 3 weeks when they can make it, once they join Market Wagon, that customer still comes to the farmer's market, loves to visit with them, loves to come to their booth. But in the intervening weeks, when it doesn't fit their schedule, they've got soccer games with the kids, they're traveling, whatever it is, they can place an order on Market Wagon. So suddenly they're being able to serve that customer through multiple channels by giving them multiple ways of getting their products.
Mm-hmm. Right. That makes total sense. And do you find, and how much do you know about your consumer, the people that shop on Market Wagon? Do you get statistics on whether or not they're driven by, you know, healthy food, slow food, wanting to know where their food comes from, organic, you know, value-based production? I mean, what do you know about the people that use Market Wagon?
We know quite a bit. We know that they're not as interested in organics as, you know, the American consumer had been over the last decade. And that's actually just going with the overall consumer trend. Organic is kind of losing some of its, yep, its heft as it gets watered down a little bit. Mm-hmm. The consumers on Market Wagon are interested in quality overall. They want good food. So, and they want to know where it comes from. It's a matter of trust. It's confidence. And what I've said for years is that certification, such as organic or any other kind of label that you could slap onto a package, is kind of a poor substitute for transparency. And when relationship is really there, when you really know where something comes from, that's when the trust is the highest. And that's what our consumers are looking for, is high trust, high confidence food that's good quality.
Now, how do you replicate that trust when you're going through a web portal? Because, you know, yes, you can like learn a little bit about the individual vendors, but you're not chatting with them, you know, in the church parking lot as you might in the physical space. So how do you build that trust with the individual consumers and the producers?
That's a really interesting topic, and you're exactly right. It's one of the things we've spent a lot of time working on that makes Market Wagon vastly different from your typical just e-commerce, which amounts to being a sophisticated catalog on your screen, right? Yep, if this was just a catalog with prices, then there's no relationship. Even if you have like a bio or you can click the little info circle and read about the farm or see a cute photo of their family. But what we created was social media-like features on the shopping platform. So you not only are shopping for products, but you can see who grew them and then follow your favorite vendors. The vendors can post to what's called a fresh feed. You can see updates about what's going on their farm. And you just mentioned, you said you're not chatting with them in the church parking lot, but you are chatting with them online. There's a live messaging back and forth with the farmers. So if you ask a question about the lettuce, how was it raised? What's the spray? Whatever the case may be, the answer is coming from the farmer. And they're directly interacting with the consumers on the website and building a relationship and building that trust that way.
That's brilliant. Did you start out with a feature like that, or did it take time to get to that point to say, you know what, we need this interactive feature?
It was pretty early on. I won't say we started with it, but it was introduced in 2017. We first launched out of beta in 2016. So this was one of the first things that we knew we needed. If we're going to be out there saying that local food is valuable because of the trust and the relationship that exists between the producer and the consumer, then we have to be facilitating that in every way that we can. And so the chat was, and Q&A was the first iterations, the fresh feed, the social media ability to follow vendors and see posts from them came along in 2018. Mm-hmm. So they've been in there from the very, very early days.
Mm-hmm. How has Market Wagon changed from, you know, its beta iteration to today?
Well, the biggest one is moving to home delivery. Prior to the pandemic, over 50% of our orders were pickups.
Interesting.
The orders would be aggregated at the fulfillment center, and then we would route them out to various community area, you know, pickup locations in communities. And it could be small retail shops that had a complementary kind of mission, maybe a butcher shop, maybe a local chocolate shop or a coffee shop. And sometimes just, you know, a local insurance agent or somebody who wanted to get visibility and was interested in helping the community. And so we had pickups. Well, all of a sudden in March 2021, nobody wanted anybody walking in their doors, right? And so home delivery became huge. Now, we had always offered home delivery, but it was, like I said, less than half of the consumers. And suddenly it was everything. And that drove us to have to create a new wave of technology, route enhancements, kind of, it's called a traveling salesman algorithm. You've got to use the software to design your routes and drop-offs because the efficiencies were key. And we innovated quite a bit there in the early parts of the pandemic in order to be able to keep up with the home delivery demand.
Wow. Well, that's yet another example of how the pandemic has, I think, sped up innovations in a number of different industries, this one included. That is really interesting. So, I mean, and I can imagine that, you know, people would want to, I mean, you know, people were obviously relying so heavily on delivery services. Do you see now that, you know, things have ostensibly, quote unquote, gone back to normal in many ways, that the delivery side is dissipated a bit? Or which, let me actually back up. Do you still offer a pickup service at all?
We don't. With one qualification, we do in a few what we call legacy markets, where the pickups never shut down. There were some locations that continued offering pickup and they participate with us. But in all of the markets that we've added over the last 4 years, we've just done home delivery. And even where pickup is available, it's no longer being adopted at the same rate. So are people, quote unquote, going back to normal? Not really. They've kind of realized how convenient home delivery is and have stuck with that.
Totally. And I have to say, I'm guilty of that myself. I mean, particularly even with curbside pickup in a number of places, I find that is, you know, when you have, you know, busy family, busy life, and you're like, okay, I'm not going to spend half an hour in the store, whether it's the grocery store or anyplace else, you just put it in the app and you pick it up. And that's just that, you know, so I think that people in their own lives recognize the convenience, no question about it. What do you see Market Wagon doing in the next 5 years?
Well, we think that every community in the U.S. should have the ability to order local food online. And Market Wagon's unique logistics approach is the way to do that. So we're continuing to find ways to open new markets, to expand further. But that ripples on the pond approach that I described earlier, it gets harder the further away those ripples get. So we're exploring ideas like franchising, partnering with other local organizations that are embedded in the communities, because, you know, at the end of the day, our mission is local food. But if we're the out-of-towners and we really don't belong there, then it's pretty notable. And we want to make sure that we are supporting the groups, the organizations that have been embedded in the communities where we're serving. And so we're looking at ways to do that, whether it's franchises, partnerships, or what have you.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. Any new markets that are on the horizon that you want to share?
Nothing new right now. We're kind of stalled on opening new markets while we, you know, figure out what's the best way to do that.
Makes sense. This has been so interesting. I like I said, you know, coming from in Northeastern Ohio and living in Columbus for a while as well, I've been familiar with the Market Wagon and its general approach. And I'm so glad that I've had an opportunity to speak with you directly to learn a little bit more about its origin story, you know, its future, and really kind of the very unique space that it occupies in the market. You have, I think, such a promising future and such an important mission for so many as consumers, I think, continue to want to demand, you know, access to fresh food as well as, you know, food that is sourced locally where they know where it comes from, as we discussed. And then, of course, which we haven't totally talked about, I want to do this before I let you go, just touch upon the role that something like Market Wagon plays in helping, you know, we'll end kind of where you started, saving the small family farm. What kind of economic impact does this have for our smaller farmers that aren't huge CAFOs and large, you know, industrial farms?
Well, thanks for letting me share the mission, because that is what's most important to me. We can talk about technology and logistics and pickups and trends, but at the end of the day, what we're doing is giving small family farms an avenue to create diversified income. So I'll use my own farm as an example, because it's really a great example, and it is a kind of an archetype of what we're seeing among all the vendors that we work with, which is, you know, my dad still raises grain, row crops. You know, he's been outfitted to do that since the early 80s. That's kind of the direction that a lot of farms went. He only has a few hundred acres, so there's some corn and soy that he's doing, which is traditional Midwestern row cropping. But he's able to switch to non-GMO corn. So he keeps back some of that corn, and we use that to feed the hogs and a little bit to the beef as well. And by raising beef on some of the land that's not as, good for row cropping, he's got a second revenue stream, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's diversified. And if the markets are down for grain, then we can increase the headcount of hogs. And you can hedge, if you will. You have the ability to play the commodities in a more intelligent and holistic way and create income that wasn't there before. Now, for someone like me, without this direct-to-consumer channel, when I turned 18, farming wasn't even really an option. There wasn't right. hardly enough income for dad, much less for me to enter the enterprise. Well, now what we've built on our own family farm is gaining enough steam to where it's a second full-time income. And by the time my kids are full grown, they're going to have the option if they choose. You know, I can't predict what they want to do, but they'll have that as a choice to enter the family business and be a farmer again. And that's the key thing. What we're seeing in the farming community, the impact of Market Wagon as a direct-to-consumer channel is we're seeing for the first time in a long time, next generation farmers, people in my generation or younger, being able to have the choice to enter into the family business, not by getting in 2,000 acres and creating a grain income that way, but hey, can I carve off these 50 acres over here and grow melons and sweet corn? Can I create yep. specialty crops, a diversified income stream, and build that up? And in order to do that, you have to have what Joel Salatin calls an embryonic development phase, you know, mm-hmm. where you're prototyping something at a minimal phase and building enough customer loyalty to make it meaningful and grow on it year after year. And that's what Market Wagon allows you to do. There's no minimums. We don't require farms to be large or have any kind of like minimum supply. So if you want to start with just a couple of hundred hens in your backyard flock and you can only produce 30, 40 dozen eggs a week, that's what you can get started doing. You can create cash flow. You can save that cash flow. You can reinvest it and you can grow your farm organically. And I think it's a huge, huge need that we've been able to fill.
Amen to that. More people need to. I am an absolute proselytizer when it comes to trying to save the small family farm. And you obviously put your money where your mouth is. This has been a really exciting conversation. Let us know, how do people find Market Wagon online?
You can find us online at marketwagon.com. There's also an app in the iOS and Android store.
Easy enough. Nick Carter, thank you so much for joining Eat Your Heartland Out.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Eat Your Heartland Out. This episode was produced by me, Capri Cafaro. Our audio engineers are Liam Warner and Armin Spengen. Theme music by Jason Shaw. You can learn more about the show by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/Eat Your Heartland Out. Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.